This episode is brought to you by Oberly Risk Strategies. Now, some of you likely know Oberly is the insurance brokerage and insurance diligence provider for the search fund community and has been trusted by search investors, lenders, searchers, and CEOs for over a decade now. The company is led by August Felker, himself a two-time successful searcher, both within the funded and self-funded models. He personally runs Oberly's dedicated search fund practice that works with searchers across the entire diligence, purchase, and post-close process. Their due diligence offering, which is 100% free of charge, by the way, will assess the pros and cons of your target company's insurance program and will summarize any potential coverage gaps, the pro forma insurance pricing, and the program structure changes needed for closing. At or shortly after closing, they will then execute on all of those findings on your behalf. In 9 out of every 10 client engagements, they're able to either reduce spend or improve coverage, all in such a way that the searcher or CEO can focus on other things, while Oberly handles all things insurance for them. Oberly has serviced over 900 customers across a decade of operation and has an NPS score that puts them at the top of their industry. But don't take my word for it. Click on the hyperlink located within the show notes or in today's episode description, and we will gladly put you in touch with as many happy Oberly customers as you'd like. This episode is brought to you by The Profit Line. Now, hopefully you guys recognize that I'm quite selective about the sponsors that I choose to partner with, but The Profit Line might just be in a league of its own, given that I was a customer of theirs for 7 consecutive years while running my own company. The Profit Line is a boutique finance and accounting firm that provides a wide range of accounting services to small and medium-sized businesses, generating anywhere between $5 to $50 million in revenue or so. On a fractional outsource basis, they will do all of your bookkeeping, bank reconciliations, month-end accruals, tax compliance, financial statement preparation, and they'll work hand-in-hand with your auditors, among countless other things. When I purchased my business, I noticed that the books were a total mess. The company's accounting wasn't compliant with GAAP, they were overly complex, and they just didn't work for the company's new reality, which suddenly included auditors, a bank, investors, and a board. Because of this, I brought in The Profit Line within my first month or so as a CEO. And fast forward to 7 years later, they were still there to help us get our books ready for an exit. We used them when we had no finance and accounting department to speak of, and continued to work with them even as we grew our finance team to 4 people, including a CFO. For those of you currently running a business, visit theprofitline.com to learn more about how they may be able to help you. For those of you currently evaluating a target to acquire, The Profit Line also offers a high-level, affordable overview of a target company's current accounting systems, processes, and environment. This analysis can be used in conjunction with your QOV project, or it can be done in advance of it to ensure that there are no large red flags before you start spending the big bucks. Again, that's theprofitline.com. In my second year as a CEO, it became clear to me that our business could benefit from formalizing and codifying our company's core values. Though I was originally fearful that they might quickly devolve into tired, cliched, and mostly hollow platitudes, I eventually came to appreciate that if they were formulated, rewarded, and communicated correctly, core values could become a powerful set of guiding principles for our company that would help us define our culture, purpose, and who we truly were, both as individuals and as a group. Though each of our values were important in and of themselves, the value to which we referred most frequently was thinking and acting like an owner. We playfully titled this, "We Take Out the Trash." To ensure that this value had substance behind it, I decided to make select employees, specifically the members of my management team, actual owners of the company by way of issuing them stock options. After all, what better way to have people act like owners than to actually make them owners? After many years of using stock options as attraction, retention, and incentive alignment tools, I've come to appreciate their merits, risks, and possible alternatives. I intend to share these lessons with you today. More specifically, though, I will argue that while options do indeed have their time and place, there are often much simpler and less expensive alternatives that arguably have a greater impact on attraction, retention, and incentive alignment. But before we get into any of that, let's broadly define what options are. the basics, definition, and major economic terms. A stock option is essentially a legal agreement that allows its holder to purchase shares in a company at a predetermined price, known as the strike price, at some point in the future. At the time of that purchase, otherwise known as exercising the option, the holder benefits from the difference between the strike price and the current fair market value of the shares in question. For example, if you have the option to purchase shares in a company at $10, but the current fair market value of those shares is $30, then the holder can buy the shares at $10, immediately sell them at $30, and pocket the $20 difference. Though stock options can feature a wide variety of legal and financial terms, those that I present below tend to be particularly common. Most importantly, as you consider issuing your own stock options, note that each of the terms below represents a possible lever for you to pull to create the specific type of incentive that you're hoping to create. So first, let's start with vesting. Vesting essentially refers to how or when an option becomes exercisable for its holder. For example, if you grant somebody options for 120 shares on January 1st and have them vest evenly throughout the course of a year, then the recipient will receive, and can exercise if they so choose, 10 shares a month for 12 months, which equates to the 120 shares that we began with. Vesting doesn't have to follow such a simple and linear schedule, however, and indeed provides the issuer of the options with plenty of creative possibilities to encourage specific behaviors. For example, options can vest based on the passage of time, whether it's monthly, quarterly, or annually, and structures like these are often used when employee retention is the primary goal. However, options can also vest based on agreed upon financial or operating results. For example, hitting a certain revenue target by a certain date. Structures like these are often used when incentive alignment or rewarding great performance is the primary goal. The second major term is something called a cliff. A cliff simply refers to when the vesting period actually begins. Using our simple example above, if there was no cliff, then the options would begin vesting immediately upon their issuance on January 1st. However, if that vesting period was subject to a 6-month cliff, then the vesting period would actually begin on July 1st, which is 6 months after their initial issuance. Cliffs tend to be particularly useful when granting options to newly hired employees. This is so because if an employee quits or is terminated prior to the cliff date, then they are not entitled to exercise any of their shares as they haven't yet begun to vest. In our example, the 6-month cliff period will be used to determine whether the newly hired employee is indeed worthy of becoming a shareholder in the company. Conversely, cliffs tend to be less common when issuing options to long-tenured employees. The third major term is the strike price. Perhaps the most fundamental term in any option contract is the strike price, that is, at what price the holder can exercise their options. Broadly speaking, there are three very different approaches to the strike price that you can choose to employ. The first option creates something called an in-the-money option. An option that is quote-unquote in-the-money is one where the strike price is less than the current fair market value of the company's shares, and note that a strike price can be set as low as a penny. In instances like these, the option acts as more of a reward for work already done, and it's largely akin to a simple share grant in many ways, as opposed to an incentive to create incremental value over and above the company's current worth. Note, however, that an in-the-money option may create material tax consequences for the holder, as they have clearly received something of value, which often represents a taxable transaction. In addition, these options often have more meaningful dilution implications for existing shareholders, and this is something that we'll describe in further detail below. Your second option with respect to strike prices is something called an at-the-money option. Most commonly, the strike price will be set at the current value of the shares at the time of issuance, which creates something called an at-the-money option. For example, if the company is worth $10 per share today, then the options issued today will also have a strike price of $10 per share. In instances like these, the options have no economic value today and only have value to the extent that the company's valuation increases in the future. For this reason, fair market value strike prices tend to be less of a reward for work already done and more of an incentive for work still yet to come. They also tend to have fewer tax consequences for the recipient, as the options granted to them don't yet have any economic value, and therefore often don't represent a taxable transaction at the time of issuance. Your third and final alternative is something called an out-of-the-money option. Out-of-the-money options feature a strike price that is greater than the current share price of the company. As a result, these tend to be more common in instances where the recipients are rewarded only for creating very material economic value for the company. Okay, the fourth major term is called acceleration. Some options feature an acceleration clause, which says that the vesting schedule gets accelerated, i.e., all of the options immediately vest, upon a change of control event, which is typically a sale or a majority recapitalization of the company. This is a common clause in instances where a liquidity event represents an explicit goal for the company, and there is a willingness on the part of management to allow employees to benefit from achieving that goal. As with each of the terms profiled here, issuers can tweak the acceleration clause to incent specific types of behaviors or outcomes. For example, acceleration clauses can be written to only come into effect at certain enterprise values. If the value of the company at the time of the change of control event is greater than a certain number, then all shares can immediately vest. If not, then the options in questions are not subject to the acceleration clause, and the holder can only exercise those options that have already vested. Major feature number 5 contemplates option forfeiture. One of the trickier clauses in most option contracts contemplates what happens to the options should the employee leave the company, whether they quit, get terminated without cause, or get terminated with cause. More specifically, the option contract will have to stipulate what happens to both vested and unvested options should the employee leave the company. Again, how you structure this specific clause may have an impact on what types of incentives you're hoping to create. For example, if retention is your primary goal, then you may choose to have a relatively punitive forfeiture policy, which would create an economic disincentive for the holder to ever leave the company. If, however, you've issued options to long-tenured employees as a sort of reward for work already done, then you may choose to utilize a more employee-friendly forfeiture policy, which often sees the holder keep their vested options even if they were to leave the company. And last but not least is a fair market value buyback. Some option contracts feature a fair market value buyback clause, which would allow the company to repurchase the shares from the recipient at a fair market value. Now, in small, illiquid, privately held companies, however, fair market value is often quite difficult to determine in any instance other than upon a liquidity event. So this clause often needs to stipulate how fair market value will be determined, usually with the help of a neutral third-party valuation firm. Okay, let's review some of the benefits of stock options. Though I do think that there are often simpler, cheaper, and more effective alternatives than options, I don't think that they're without value entirely. Indeed, options can play a meaningful role in your overall retention, attraction, and incentive alignment strategy. Below is a list of some of their primary benefits. First, options do indeed allow key employees to benefit financially from a liquidity event, which is fitting given that those same employees often help to create the value being crystallized by the transaction in the first place. In addition to this, remember that members of your senior leadership team are likely to play key roles in the transaction process itself. Things like responding to questions, furnishing diligence requests, and so on. So it usually doesn't hurt to provide them with an incentive to do the best job possible throughout the course of that process. Second, more qualitatively, but not to be overlooked, is the symbolic or optical importance of making a key employee an owner of the company. Even if the financial rewards associated with options are difficult to value and may reside many years into the future, simply being granted options is often a very meaningful gesture, especially for employees who have never participated in something similar in the past. Related to this, options may also indeed play a key role in incenting owner-like behaviors by their holders. If you're an owner of the company, you may be more likely to book your next hotel at the Red Roof Inn instead of the Four Seasons. Next, in certain industries, early-stage technology and software immediately come to mind, options have grown into a prerequisite of sorts, often required to attract new in-demand employees. The importance of being able to issue options to new employees is particularly important for smaller, resource-constrained companies who may not be able to pay market salaries. Next, depending on the wording of the forfeiture clause described above, I think it's reasonable to suggest that options do indeed play a role in retaining key employees, especially if the value of the options is reasonably well understood by the recipient, a liquidity event is a realistic possibility, and the dollar amount involved is material. And finally, options can sometimes act as an important attraction mechanism for external board members who may not have had the chance to be an original investor in the company. Okay, now let's look at the opposite side of the coin, the challenges and drawbacks of options. Without negating any of the very real benefits discussed above, my experience is that the value of options as attraction, retention, and incentive alignment tools is higher at an intellectual level than at a practical level. And this is so for several reasons, including the following. First, options are relatively complicated financial instruments, and they tend to elicit as much confusion as they do excitement on the part of their recipients. Second, related to this, options are very hard to value, especially in small, privately held companies where there is no liquid market for the shares and no opportunity for price discovery. How valuable is an at-the-money option to purchase 20,000 shares in a small marketing consultancy at some point in the future? What happens if we never sell the company? How do I know that the strike price chosen is indeed representative of the current value of the company? These are all very reasonable questions for any option recipient to ask. Next, options are illiquid and don't have any inherent value unless and until there is some sort of liquidity event. As someone once told me, I can't buy groceries with options. With options, there's typically a very long time that elapses between behavior, like increasing revenue, and reward, like collecting proceeds from a liquidity event. As any introductory psychology textbook will tell you, incentives are most powerful when there is a very short period of time that elapses between behavior and reward. As a result, it's reasonable to propose that options may not have the incentive power that most introductory finance textbooks might suggest. For this reason, options are often treated as lottery tickets of sorts among their recipients that may have some upside in the future, but possess very uncertain, if any, value today. Next, the size of any given option pool, that is, the number of options that a company is permitted to offer to its employees, is typically determined by the company's board of directors and has to appropriately weigh the pitfalls of dilution against the potential benefits specific to attraction and retention of key employees. Though any option pool tends to be better than no option pool, some option pools are so small that they never really get the opportunity to have their desired effects, especially if the plan is to distribute them across a large number of different employees. Next, beyond some of the complexity already discussed, remember that when options are exercised, the holders of those options become actual shareholders in the company. When there are several shareholders present, often there is a requirement for a shareholders agreement, itself a long, complex, and multivariable legal agreement that governs the rights, responsibilities, and relationship between the company's various shareholders. If you don't currently have one in place, you may need to draft one, which can be a long, complicated, and expensive process. Next, under the right circumstances, options can be taxed as a capital gain, which represents much more favorable tax treatment relative to something like a cash bonus, which would be treated as ordinary income for the recipient. With that said, though, most jurisdictions tend to have very specific rules around when option proceeds can be taxed as a capital gain and when they can be taxed as ordinary income. For example, in Canada, employees must have exercised their options and must have held them for at least 2 years before they're eligible for capital gains treatment. If options remain unexercised, or if they were exercised less than 2 years ago, then they lose their tax advantage. And last but not least, closely related to the tax point that I just mentioned, when employees exercise options, they have an obligation to actually write a check to the company for the value of those options, and that check is going to be equal to the strike price per share times the number of shares that they're choosing to exercise. In many instances, this could represent tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash that most employees simply don't have on hand. Of course, employees could choose to exercise their options only upon a liquidity event, which tends to be a cashless transaction as their buy-in simply gets netted out from their transaction proceeds. But again, such a scenario would see them lose their capital gains tax treatment as they have not been exercised and held for at least 2 years. Okay, let's discuss other alternatives for attraction, retention, and incentive alignment. Depending upon the incentives that you're hoping to create, there are several other options that CEOs can utilize to achieve their attraction, retention, and incentive alignment goals. I present some of these alternatives below, but won't comment on their tax and dilution implications for the sake of brevity. First, profit sharing programs, where employees are entitled to X percent of a company's annual profit, or even Y percent of a company's annual profit over and above a certain target number. Next, a simple cash-based closing bonus that could scale up with higher levels of enterprise value paid to key employees upon a liquidity event. Next, phantom equity. A slightly more formalized version of the closing bonus that I just mentioned is phantom equity, where employees receive hypothetical shares that track the value of the company's actual equity. This isn't real equity per se, but is instead a promise to pay out a future cash bonus based on the appreciation in the value of the company over a specified period of time. Phantom equity plans are often used by privately held companies that are not able to offer traditional stock options or equity grants for any given reason. My favorite method of all, however, also happens to be the simplest: a simple cash bonus paid to an employee once they achieve some sort of desired outcome. This could take the form of a stay bonus paid to critical employees 6 to 12 months after acquiring their company, that would be retention focused, or it could be a bonus for beating a certain revenue or profit target, that would be reward focused, or a signing bonus for a new employee, and that could be attraction focused. The reasons why I like this approach so much are almost the complete inverse of why I find options to be so imperfect. Simple cash bonuses are simple, they're easy to value, they're easy to understand, they're liquid, you can indeed buy groceries with cash bonuses, they feature a very short time period between action and reward, which usually increases their motivational qualities, they don't require a shareholder's agreement to be drafted, they're flexible, given that they can change each year or quarter or month, depending on what's most important to the company at that particular point in time. They allow you to change course and correct mistakes more easily. If you preemptively offer options to certain employees during your first month as a CEO, only to realize 12 months later that the person in question was never really worthy of those options in the first place, well, you have very little recourse. With a cash bonus under similar circumstances, however, you can simply elect not to offer a similar cash bonus next year. And finally, if the employee in question leaves for any given reason, usually they simply forfeit their right to the cash bonus payment with no further legal or financial headaches. In sum, though stock options certainly have their time and place, my direct experience suggests that there are often much simpler and less expensive alternatives that arguably have a greater benefit on attraction, retention, and incentive alignment. For the reasons articulated above, the next time that you consider offering options to your key employees, ask whether it might be better to offer them a simple cash